Scotty, have you sensed my happiness? Not that you would ever be attuned to these things because you're mostly mean, but I'm very happy.
John, your happiness has been rippling across the entire continent of the US, across the Atlantic, through the wilds of the south coast of England and right up into East Bollockshire's very centre.
I love knowing that I create
I was almost going to say rectum, then decided not to.
That was very kind of you. Surprisingly, what's the word? Withdrawn. We'll have to explore that more deeply later.
Move on, John. Move on.
Okay. So no, I'm happy because I think that there were people were hanging, you know, waiting for the time to pass between last episodes and this episode to find out if John finally, you know, got the girl, got the happiness, and rode off into the sunset. In fact, all those things are true. I solved my problem, and I'm kind of embarrassed to say that it was in the end not at all what I thought it was, but it gave a very interesting lesson in debugging.
Okay, then teach us. Definitely.
Well, so the fundamental problem had to do with the fairly unusual situation of taking a view controller whose view is housed in a place that's not normally done. Normally, when you have view controllers, they're like child view controllers of something that's presented full screen. But in this particular case, they was just housed in a table view or a collection view cell. And there are multiple of the same thing. So there adds a certain complexity. And so then at some point, you want to detach them and present them full screen. And then when they're dismissed from being full screen, the view needs to go back from whence it came. And what I had noticed is that they were seemingly disappearing when they were sent back. And in fact, they weren't disappearing. They were just being recreated because there was code that's done to, you know, because collection view cells and table view cells get recycled, that causes the view controller in question to be recreated, and the view controller in question also has its own child view controllers which get removed at certain times. And I'm sorry, I have to speak vaguely, but I do. So in the end, what looked like disappearing wasn't really, because this view controller's view's background is normally transparent. And so the debugging trick I did, which is kind of brain dead stupid, is just to give it a color, because normally if you see a color, it means that it's in a kind of a brand new initialized state, and the stuff that should have been there to fill it in wasn't. So that provided a clue. Because normally you would, as I said, I only saw the color when it was dismissed from having gone full screen, gone back and popped back into the view. And so in the end, what ended up happening, it had to do with who was being rotated, because with table views and collection view cells, you know, they have to relay out when conditions force them to relay out, because if, let's say, the table view gets resized, which happens if, you know, it happens if something's being rotated, right? And I think the other part of the problem was that I wanted the presented view controller to rotate upon presentation, but I didn't want the underlying one to rotate, because it just never should. But there was a time in the way that I was setting up my animation, my transition delegate, that I allowed the underlying view controller to rotate. And there were other cases where, because of some cleanup code that's necessarily there, it stopped processes that would cause the child view controller and my presented view controllers to disappear. So when I tracked down those two problems, everything was just working beautifully, and I could get back to what I originally wanted to do, was to completely refine the transition, which I'm still able to do. But in the end, as I said, it kind of... The fact that I thought that it had something to do with the custom transition style was a red herring. It's just that the custom transition style would not cause any rotation at all. It just presents it, from the bottom. And I figured that was just, I didn't realize that really the problem was rotation and cleanup that shouldn't have happened. So anyway, I'm very happy.
This is where we really need to play some happy music of some sort, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm happy. I'm also, it's like one of those things where sometimes you have, you know, bugs that take you a long time to figure out, and they're frustrating. They lead you down lots of different paths. And sometimes you kind of just give up and say, well, I can't figure it out. Or maybe it's somewhere in the bowels of somebody else's code. And I just don't want to, I don't want to know. I don't care if it doesn't make sense because I'm so tired of dealing with it. I just find another solution. And I was getting at that point. I was like, you know, I almost don't care. But in this case, when things make perfect sense, then you feel better in an odd way, because I just hate not knowing.
Yeah, not knowing is frustrating more than hating, I'd say, isn't it?
Sure.
Because there's always going to be someone who knows, and you just need to get the right connection.
Yeah, but I think the other thing too is talking about it helps. I mean, we touched on that last time, but I think a lot of times the other thing too is I've said this many times, like classic debugging tips are classic debugging tips. It doesn't matter what programming language or framework. If you're doing debugging of graphical user interfaces, garish colors are totally your friend because it's so easy when things get built up in layers that it becomes very easy to think that something has disappeared when it may not have. It may be just being recreated. And the easiest way to tell that is to make it so that upon immediate initialization, you know that part of it's there. And especially if the complete experience requires multiple layers on top of it, you can give each of the different layers different colors. So you can kind of see what part of the layers is, which of the layers are not there. And so I think if I had the same problem on web or any other platform, I would have done the same thing.
See, this is where it isn't always possible, but it is more possible than people normally make it by just thinking a little bit ahead about it. If you make everything as you go down a tree of views or whatever it is you're putting together, have the minimal number of connections to whatever is above it. In other words, you know, only communicate in one direction where possible, or only have, you know, connectivity one way. And if it's anything that goes the other way is done through delegation or messaging or some other way, that makes it possible to quite easily just switch other things in and out. So you can start stripping your hierarchy right back to the top and just putting in a color view instead and see what happens. And then if that works, putting something down that now does a grid within those or whatever it might be. Often we, out of laziness and not spending time thinking, we end up with all these intricate two-way connections between, let's call them parent and child, in these hierarchies, which make that type of debugging very, very difficult. But it's in those situations where the most simplistic connections, all the communication goes one way if it's direct communication. Anything else that goes the other way is indirect communication. You can make your life a little bit easier for debugging.
Totally true. And the funny thing is that, you know, as part of the problem of trying to say, well, let's remove the potential kind of difficulty of having, you know, complex child view controller hierarchies, I created a simple one, which was a kind of a dummy view controller that just had a red background and a simple button on it. And I had done that, and the thing again about that one is that that's where it stopped. It didn't include the child view controllers because I kept thinking, well, I didn't want to deal with that possibility. But in fact, if I stuck through and not made my dummy view controller, but instead had done what I ended up doing, giving a background color, a garish background color, I could have found it a little bit sooner. But that's sometimes you just in the process of trying to figure out what's going on, you start to eliminate choices. But what you're saying is completely true. It's like, you know, it really does help to have it go one way only if you possibly can.
Yeah, you can't stop things being complicated. You know, a modern iOS app has often very complicated UI, lots of them do. So you can't say, oh, just keep it simple. But what you do is make sure that your complexity is made up of lots of simple parts.
Yeah, exactly.
Because then you can swap things out. And as you said, the explaining things, it just helps you think things through. We had a good example of that here in the office this week where my colleague had been fighting a bug for a few hours. And he said, oh, can you take a look at this? And he said, I'm doing this. And by the third sentence, he said, yeah, and there's the problem. But it's because the explaining it forced him to take a step back. Because I had no idea what he was doing, I take a step back further than he was taking a step back when trying to debug it, because he just couldn't believe that it was something that far out and that simple. So, yeah, that very fact of explaining things is, as we said last week, it's useful. Explain it to somebody. Keep everything as simple as you can. Even your complexity is a multiplication of simplicity. And make sure as fewer connections as possible, and life will be a little easier, but still frustrating.
Indeed.
So I actually had a reasonably nice experience with React Native this week.
Wow.
And when I say reasonably nice, I'm being quite generous. and I have no idea if in the long run this will be any good. I was messing around developing a visual aspect of an application, and I wanted a mosaic view. So a view where you chuck it in a whole bunch of images and it displays them in a mosaic way, maintaining the aspect ratio of every image, but equally having no gaps in the mosaic. So you end up with a nice full screen of images, all the way they're supposed to look, not cropped, not square, in that way, but filling the screen. And you basically do that by, first of all, doing the math to put them in rows, where you get a width, and then you adjust the height of each row to maintain the aspect ratio properly, but fit the width. So the height of each row in the effectively the grid will be slightly different. Equally, if you have one image left at the end, for example, the height might be very big just to make one image take up the whole width, so you don't end up with any nasty white space other than defined margins. The math, fairly straightforward. It's done before, wasn't difficult. But often when you're trying to lay that sort of stuff out on iOS, the whole bunch of layout code for that becomes quite, again, not necessarily difficult, but quite messy of having to get in there. But of course, because React Native is more of a, comes from the React stable for web development, where you just literally just throw views, edit with effectively CSS on them, and then let it do its own layout. The actual layout of this stuff was really, really easy and really fast, where I could imagine myself fighting for hours in native code to make this work. And so that was a pleasant surprise. Of course, now I had the caveat. I've no idea what happens when you throw 1,000 images at it yet. I've no idea how performant this is. I've no idea what React Native is doing in the background that's going to make this slow in the future. Or I've no idea how I could optimize it because I can't get down in there. I've no idea if it's reusing image cells or it's just throwing them all away. So I put all that around the outside of saying these are all things I still don't particularly know or like. But I will have to just give it credit that for laying out a reasonably complex view of sets of images, it was an incredibly simple and nice experience. And so I've been giving it a real downer for a number of weeks. I thought it'd be just nice if I just give it a little bit of a thumbs up, which I will probably dismiss when I start putting this thing in for real, because I said it might perform like shite, but there we go.
Well, so this is what I don't understand. You can't, I mean, React Native does all of it in real time. So it takes the JavaScript and the CSS, like, is it actual CSS or just a CSS like set of declarations?
It's CSS like. Okay. So basically inside, you have components, which are JavaScript components, which you apply a style. Most of them have a style property which you apply CSS-like attributes to in a JSON format. So they might have like margin left, margin top, a border, that type of thing. And it works out what it needs to do when it draws UI views eventually to make this work.
Right.
So, for example, when I was working out the math, I knew what my margins were. I knew if I was the last or not the last in a row, I could just say, here's the image, and the margin after this one needs to be 10 pixels, and it would just sort that out.
But so when you say that it converts that, you know, that bit of CSS-like attributes into UI views that are placed somewhere, at some point you can't see what it ends up producing? You can't stop the app in Xcode and look at the view hierarchy and see, are they using a collection view or just dumping views?
You can introspect the app in the simulation like you could with anything else and break down the views and use all that stuff. So I'm not saying you can't see it. What I'm saying is, because it's React Native, you can't necessarily change
how it decides to do it, right?
Yeah. So you may see that it's doing all these views and throw them away and not reusing them, but there's not really a lot you can do about that necessarily, unless you go and write your own stuff again. Because basically, you know, React Native is a set of libraries that you put into your project, and then basically the JavaScript calls into the native libraries, and it says, you know, here's, I'm a JavaScript view, native library, here's all my stuff. You work out what you're doing. So you could replace it. You could go and rewrite the native library. If you're using a custom component that someone else has written that's doing lots of native stuff, what will normally happen is it will come in the form of an NPM module, and that NPM module will be the JavaScript, and equally within there will be a iOS project, and equally probably an Android project. And when you install them, there's normally scripts run which then add those native projects as sub-projects to the native projects that are in your React Native project, and then they get built in so they can be called and used. So, of course, you can just go and write your own stuff to do it. One of the problems is often you go find a component and someone's only written the iOS native side of it, not the Android side of it, because I think React Native is reasonably popular on iOS. Not massively, but reasonably, whereas on Android, it's hardly being used, I think. So when people head out to do this cross-platform Nirvana with it, I think they often find them, it's actually usable on iOS in certain circumstances, especially if you're doing really simple apps. It's a really good way of putting them together really quite quickly with the UI and everything. Dealing with the Android side can be a little fiddlier. But anyway, it's on the whole, I'm still fairly anti the way it's doing things, just because I think it's just too messy a tool chain personally for my liking. Not to everybody's. I know there are people who love it. I'm just saying my personal preference. But I was going to give it its due. I can understand if you were just trying to knock this thing up as a prototype or whatever else. In a few hours, I did what would have probably taken me a lot longer if I could only use native code enough to be responsible for the view layout, or trying to coerce a collection. I'd have probably had to write a custom collection view layout to make this work, which is not a 10-minute job. Just gonna give it a thumbs up, and I'll let you know when I'm cursing it next time.
Okay, well, cursing React Native in 3, 2, 1. Scotty, how do you like React Native?
Oh, it's shite.
Okay, good. The order has been restored.
Yes. Yeah, so last week I was talking about laptops and desktops and not knowing what to do. So I've sort of half solved my problem. I've sort of borrowed a 2017 15-inch MacBook Pro, one of the touch bar ones, reasonable spec. Obviously, the main issue I had with the 2017 ones was you can only have 16 gig of memory, but there we are. Which is sort of good because I can carry on doing stuff on that and whatever else. Although I'm doing a lot of stuff with Elixir and Elm and that I was talking about last week, and I can't really, for reasons I won't go into, install a whole bunch of crap on this laptop. So I'm sort of half-assing my experiment by. What I've done is I've installed a VM on the laptop to do my non-Mac iOS work, which I can do on the laptop because that's all installed and set up. So where I have to install all this other stuff and whatever without polluting the laptop. So I've installed a VM on there. So it's not going to be quite the full experience because, that a VM is always slower. Because I tried for a long time running a different VM for every client I was working with, and on the iMac with 32 gig of memory and a big beefy processor, that sort of works okay. Back on a Mac Pro or an iMac Pro, that would work probably very well. So basically, you can have just your own configuration, a nice clean setup for every client or every project, just make it work. Never works that well on a MacBook Pro because it's just not beefy enough machine to run the VMs well. It just doesn't do it. I've tried lots of times. And part of the problem there is, Mac OS is quite a heavy operating system. So in the VM, I've actually installed Linux, and I'm going to develop the web stuff I'm doing under Linux, which is going to be a bit fiddly, but actually, I've got to deploy a lot of this stuff to Linux, so I'm taking the assumption that what I'm learning about Linux as I go along there will be useful going along the line. And once again, I said I've been doing all this stuff in VS Code. There is a Linux version of VS Code because it's an Electron app. So actually, my editor is still the same. And once I just into the editor in the folder, as long as I've got the command line Git and Visual Studio Code, most of it just feels the same. Chrome is the browser I'm using on there. So that's going to be interesting to see how it works. So I'm just going to play with this for a few weeks and see how that gets on. Equally, that gives me time to see really if we start getting more evidence of the new MacBook keyboards are still no better than the old ones, because you know that really is a bugbear to me. I don't want to buy something that's faulty. So yeah, it's that's how I've basically delayed solving my problem and made my life a little bit more complicated.
Well, there we are. I think that from an engineering perspective, that's a cleaner solution than what I'd suggested about having, you know, somebody carry your machine on their back through the rabbit trail. So good on you for doing that.
Yes. Yeah, so some more follow up. This is a total follow up show, isn't it? Everything's going to be follow up. Last week I said I was going to an Elixir conference. If people don't know, Elixir is a functional language built on top of Erlang. So Erlang has been around since the 1980s, I think. Erlang was developed for the communications industry. So I would imagine basically, I think this is probably true, any SMS message ever sent in the world will go through an Erlang system somewhere on its way through. So, I mean, it's designed for, you know, pretty good fault tolerance, high volume stuff. But it was a fairly obscure language, a bit arcane in some of its handling. So basically, Elixir is a cleanup of the syntax of Erlang to make it more usable in a way. A little bit like Objective-C did over C, you might say, because you can drop into raw Erlang anyway you like. And I'm using this to develop an API for something I'm looking at doing. So went to an Elixir conference last week in London, which was a nice experience. What it was nice is Elixir has only been around for a few years, or shall we say it's only been around to the level that someone, yeah, there is a community for a few years. It was very, very, very much unique before that. It's still tiny. One of the presentations said that they believe, you know, less than 2% of developers know anything about Elixir, which is, so it's very, very small. They were trying to make a sales point that, you know, about 4% of companies are looking for Elixir developers. So they're trying to say this is a good market, but there we are. But anyway, it was quite interesting to get in on something that is still reasonably young, but still quite well established. But it was interesting, because I said last week it's a single track conference with advanced and basic sessions, and yet I held my own in all of them. There was one on blockchain where I really didn't, but that's partly because anytime I hear the word blockchain, I just want to stab myself viciously with a blunt instrument, because it's just like, I have no idea. It just does that to me. So I'm not blaming the session. I am blaming my mental health for that one. But no, I managed to follow along, and it's, you know, I've not been doing that much Elixir, but I've been playing with it. But I think, again, it just showed me that even though functional languages are something I have very little experience of, syntax is something I have very little experience of, just generally, if you are a developer who enjoys your craft and learns things about your craft over a period of time, you will just be able to take things on board that in the past would have been difficult. So, you know, picking up something new. I think that's the case. I think it's because I have that experience, which actually made it a very enjoyable day. But one of the things that struck me about the day, this is leading into another discussion, I don't know if you had any to this, is there was a session on using Elixir with GraphQL. Now, I don't know, have you ever looked into GraphQL?
A little bit.
Yeah, so I've been to a couple of GraphQL sessions at some iOS conferences actually probably back in 2017. I don't even think it was this year, maybe even 16. Always had a sort of slight bit of interest, but it's never quite caught my attention to the point of taking it anywhere forward. But this presentation was done so well and sold the concept of GraphQL so well that is something I'm now going to look into, because basically the idea of GraphQL is, instead of having a REST API where you say, give me the customer, and it will give you back the customer, all the data for the customer, or you have to begin putting a whole plethora of parameters in to say, well, don't give me all the data, just give me the summary of the customer or whatever else, is it's more about you have a single endpoint on your API and you pass it a query, which is basically like JSON, that says, I want customer 1, 2, 3, 4, and these are the fields I want from the customer. Oh, and by the way, why don't you give me the orders for the customer as well? Well, I actually want the order IDs, and it's in a schema, and then you have a GraphQL server which matches it, checks you the validity of your schema, and then returns you that data. So basically what you're saying is, instead of saying, we are a REST API, here's the data you can have, it goes to the other way and saying, we're an API, you tell us the data you want.
Right.
Of course, you can then have lots of authentication around it, so the public API can have one schema, whereas a private API that's behind authentication can have a wider schema with more information, such as, you know, sales or whatever. And as at the moment, what the API we're developing is really for our own use primarily, although the idea was to develop everything we develop against an API. So if we decide to make it public, we can make the full API public. Actually, I'm thinking, why aren't we just producing a GraphQL server for the schema of the stuff we're trying to do, and then just accessing that from our iOS app or the web app, because that's going to be a lot more flexible. So I'm beginning to explore GraphQL. Now, very early, just bought a book. In fact, as soon as the session finished, I went and bought a book on a product called Absinthe, which is a sort of GraphQL framework for Elixir, so to try and learn that stuff. But the concept of it. So, but I'm interested, if anyone's out there, I'm interested to anyone who's used GraphQL in a production application. I know it's a fairly new technology, but it is a few years old now, so it'll be interesting to see.
Well, I can say that at Netflix there's a technology called Falcor and PQL, which is, as far as I can tell, the same thing. That GraphQL was invented at Facebook, was it not?
And it was, yeah. But
it's conceptually the same thing. I mean, took me a little while to kind of wrap my head around. It makes much more sense now, because back in the early days, it was that problem that you have an API and you have a RESTful endpoint, and it gives you those things, and you have to, exactly right. It's like, let's say that you have multiple clients. You have to then add a bunch of complexity on the server to be able to decide, well, the Android only needs this because of whatever, whereas iOS, can be made more performant if we want this. And then there's the web client, and now think about it from Netflix perspective, where you have, all sorts of connected TV devices. So it was early on, it became very clear that you needed a way to be able to give just the right representation of the data that would be up to each client team to figure it out. So it the concept really does work well.
It does. Right. Well, that's been mainly a week of follow-up. Oh, I've got an announcement. Can I do a selfish announcement?
Yes, you can.
Okay. So, in my local town here in East Bollockshire, I've been part of running the volunteer youth services here for a number of years, and a charity to do that, and decided we could do with a little bit more funding, so I was going to do something for charity. Now, I'm an old man, an overweight old man, not quite as overweight as I used to be, but still an overweight old man, but I've decided to run 2 half marathons on consecutive weekends in an attempt to raise a little bit of money. So if it's all right with you, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to where people could go and maybe give me a couple of dollars for my pain.
Absolutely.
To do there, just to do it. And yeah, it's a bit of it is like, I wanted to set myself a goal or something this year to do that I would never have done in my life before. But equally, why not try and let someone else benefit from it? So if you are so inclined, listener, no, we have 1.5 listeners now. We must find a term for, because it's not quite 2 listeners, is it? So we can't really be plural. There needs to be some other term. Or we could just try and find another half a listener, I guess. Anyway, I digress. if you are so inclined, please do visit the show notes and click on the link and support the children of East Bollockshire. I'm sure John will at some point tell you about their scruffy clothing and their cloth caps and the gruel that we have to eat here or something of that nature, which will be totally untrue but may work as far as promoting this is concerned.
Well, Scotty, if people want to send dollars or to get more inspiration as to why they should do this, how can they find you on the internet?
I am on micro.blog as Scotty, or I still do look at Twitter, but not really post there, as MacDevNet. Or, of course, they can get hold of both of us by sending an email to feedback@ideveloper.co.
You should really change that to feed the kids.
I have to say, we are not a Feeding the Poor of East Bollockshire charity. It's not like we're some desperate that way. It is about providing an educational fun.
All right. Well, for people who would like to goad me into doing it, they can do so on the Twitters, where I'm djembe, like the West African drum. That's DJEMBE.
So, John, with all the follow-up covered this week, we can almost say join us again next week for all original material.
That's true.
It is. Well, no, let's not say true. It's possible. Let's not overcommit. It's possible.
Okay. It's possible.
All right. And with that promise, how would you refuse to not come back? That didn't make any sense. How could you not? I don't know. Thanks for listening. Until next time, you take care.